You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The latest episode of the Show Before the Show podcast, the official podcast of Minor League Baseball. It's the middle of April, and we've got a surprise correspondent on the road on this week's episode of the Show Before the Show, getting set to check out the top pitching prospect in baseball. We've got our stalwart Ben Hill with the first couple of weeks of minor league promos and such already in the bag, and more fun stuff to come. And those are the two dudes who are on my computer screen right now. Sam Dykstra is in Indianapolis. Benjamin Hill is in New York City. Coming to you live from America's best pizza city, my name is Tyler Mon. And Sam, what's going on? You're in a hotel in Indianapolis on kind of short notice.
You know, this week I got an assignment to cover Paul Skeens Day, which is fun and exciting. I mean, he's making a start here on Thursday night for the Indianapolis Indians. I believe that's his fourth start of the season. He's topped out at 3 1/3 innings so far. We'll see how deep he makes it tonight. That seems to be the big bellwether, is how long are the Pirates going to allow him to pitch in a start before getting that major league call up? Maybe when he gets closer to 5 or 6, that's when they start to consider it. Ben Charrington talked this week about that they just want to see him add bulk, but they don't want to see that bulk come in April either. I think that's one thing that people are kind of getting wrapped up in. Like, they want him pitching into September. It's great that he was throwing 6, 7, 8 innings last year at LSU at this time, but LSU wasn't having him pitch in August and September, and the Pirates have hopes that will happen. So I'm excited to see Paul Skeens live here myself. Tonight we'll be writing that up. We'll see how it goes, but we'll be writing up regardless and then talking to him tomorrow for a future story on MLB.com.
Paul Skeens' line so far this season, 3 starts, 9 1/3 innings, 4 hits, no runs, 19 strikeouts, and 2 walks. In his first outing, he struck out 5 3 innings. Second outing, he struck out 6 3 innings. In his third outing, he struck out 8 3 1/3. He's as good as advertised so far. And obviously, you know, if you're a fan in Indianapolis, you kind of got to get down to check out a game while Paul Skeens is still there, because we don't really know how long this is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, that really is the thing, is that everybody is talking about, like, you know, AAA is, every game feels like an audition. For him, it doesn't seem that way, because the quality of stuff is just so good right now that it could get major leaguers out. It's not so much an audition, it's just building up for him. So tonight will be the next step in that. Again, we'll see how far he goes. You guys, by the time you listen to this, will know that answer better than we will. But with every passing outing, I mean, it's 100 plus miles an hour with a fastball. It's a really good slider, a really good changeup. He's shown a curveball. And one thing I want to ask him about is this pitch that looks like a Yoan Duran splinker, to be honest with you. It's in the low 90s. It's around the velocity of what a sinker would be, but it has the spin rate of a splitter, and it's kind of out on an island. If you look at the horizontal and vertical metrics that he has, and if he's adding that pitch on top of the velocity, on top of the slider, we were excited to see Paul Skeens coming into the year for sure, being a number one overall pick. But if he's doing new stuff like this, the sky's the limit for him before he even reaches Pittsburgh.
It's kind of funny. Have you ever seen one of those cars driving around with like the weird camo paint? That's like a wrap job, I should say. That's like a manufacturer's prototype. You're not supposed to really know what it is. That's like this Paul Skeens pitch, where it's like he's rolling it out. We don't really know what it is as of yet. And it hasn't been officially announced, but it's like his test mule. That's what this pitch is, I think. He's just rolling out a new product.
Yeah. And even Henry Davis, former number one overall pick himself, was talking about it this spring, of like, once he gets used to throwing this, look out. And it's like, what do you mean look out? Everybody's already looking out, because the guy's throwing 102, 103 with a wipeout slider. Like, you mean there's something else in the tank here? I mean, if he's still learning in that way, I think that's super exciting for Pirates, the Pirates organization and Pirates fans, that he's not a guy just resting on his laurels, or in this case, resting on his heater.
All right. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about Paul Skeens and what Sam is doing in Indianapolis. But a guy who's very familiar with Indianapolis and Indians game and games in Victory Field, correct? In Indianapolis, the legend himself, Ben Hill. Ben, I have never been to an Indy game. I've been through Indianapolis, but that's a place with a ton of baseball history, and that is one of the oldest AAA franchises, AAA franchise monikers. Tell us about, the Indianapolis baseball community, what it's like going to a game at Victory Field, and kind of what Paul Skeens is experiencing in his first AAA stop.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to say I'm against these portmanteaus to describe pitches.
Splinker? You
I think
don't like
Sam is.
Splinker?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't on board with Slurve and have had to suffer through that. And then to
Was a
have my
while back.
own, yeah, I know, but I never liked that. Then to have my own co-host, my own peer and friend start calling things splinkers, like, come on.
Ben feels
How do you feel
betrayed.
about the slider and cutter there, Ben?
Yeah, we don't say the name of that
We
on
don't use that
podcast.
one. The,
It's got to
well,
be
there,
a
that's one where we
slider.
don't need a portmanteau for.
Yeah, that's true, but there is one, and I even saw it on a scoreboard last year. I can't remember where I was, but someone pointed it out, and I was like, really? You're just going to identify that pitch on the scoreboard? Come up with new names for pitches. Don't just combine two pre-existing names.
Here's an issue that I've had. Why has nobody figured out how to throw a three-seam fastball?
Yeah, I know. They
Got a
just.
two-seamer. You got a four-seamer. We can't
There's
split
even a
the difference?
one-seamer. There is a
Yeah,
one-seamer.
there's a one-seamer. You can't split the difference? Can't find three seams? Rip off. Anyway.
I'm trying to think of like who would be the candidate to do that. There's got to be some pitch design wizard out there. Maybe Tyler Glass now. I don't know. He likes playing.
Somebody could do it. Let's find let's
Yeah.
get let's get Rob Friedman on and see if the pitching ninja can give us a breakdown on how you do a three seam fastball. Anyway, Ben, sorry, I took that a whole different way.
Yeah, well, no, I apologize. I had to go on a unassociated rant. Going back to your question, yeah, Sam is in Indianapolis. Paul Skeens is in Indianapolis. The Indianapolis Indians, Tyler, like you mentioned, they date back to the very, very early days of the 20th century. I mean, that franchise, not just baseball in the city, but that franchise with that name. There are other team names in minor league baseball currently in use that go back further in terms of their first usage, but I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the Indianapolis Indians had the longest running team name, like 1903 to right now. So, like you said, a ton of baseball history in that area. Victory Field opened in the 90s. I should know that about 25 years ago. And before that, they played at a ballpark that has since been converted. I believe is Busch Stadium, not Busch Stadium, like where the Cardinals played, obviously.
BUSH,
Yeah,
very
BUSH.
slightly
And
different words of history.
yeah, and talking to Portmanteau Dykstra before we started recording, he said he drove by those apartments today, so he
I
saw
was
the.
going to ask if you were planning on it, so that's very cool.
Yes. I actually, by the time we finish this podcast, I'll be posting some pictures of what's called Stadium Lofts over there now. It's just a apartment complex, like you were saying, Ben. It's all the seats, all the inner bowl is just turned into apartments, and there's some other stuff around there, but like they even have old ballpark seats outside.
So cool.
Looking up the history of that stadium, not only did the Indianapolis Indians play there, the Indianapolis Clowns played there. Henry Aaron, when he won a Negro League American title, played for the Indianapolis Clowns, who played in that stadium. Going outside of baseball, Eight Men Out was filmed in part
I don't
at
think
that
I knew that.
stadium. Yeah.
It also was a it was a car race oval, I believe, a racetrack
Yes,
or
it was a
yeah. A
short
short
track
track,
race
yeah.
place. Yeah.
Like demolition derbies and stuff. And then for a while it sat abandoned and it was like a junkyard. It was like a car, I believe the previous owners just used it for like scrap metal and hosting clunkers there.
Exactly. Yeah. So now it's being used to house people, which is, I think, terrific.
Very cool.
It's interesting to see these people whose backyard is just a normally kept baseball infield. I don't know if there's a groundskeeper going out there every day and, keep
They're
making
just
sure
they're
the.
dragging the infield for
Yeah, exactly.
games that will not come.
padding down home plate and all that jazz. But I mean, you know, it looked like a normal ballpark just with apartments. It was really cool to see. So I'm going to post some pictures to social media here in a little bit about that. So if you're listening to this podcast, go check them out to see it for yourself.
Yeah, so a lot of history, and I wanted to go to those lost last year, but I just did not have the time within the flow of that particular itinerary. But Victory Field is in the heart of downtown Indianapolis, and you know, Indianapolis is in many ways a major league city, not Major League Baseball, but Lucas Oil Stadium, the home of the Colts, is visible from Victory Field. The state capitol is visible from Victory Field. So there's just a lot going on. I mean, now Caitlin Clark is going to be playing in Indianapolis. So there's some, you know, serious sports energy in that city with the WNBA, the NBA, the NFL, and then right in the thick of it too, the AAA Indianapolis Indians. And that ballpark, even though it's not a new ballpark anymore, it looks beautiful. And if you've never been, highly recommend going, especially on a summer night in Indianapolis. I was there last September, so it was, you know, edging towards fall, but it was a beautiful, warm night. There was a concert at the amphitheater across the street. The Colts were actually starting their season the next day, so there was a lot going on in the city. And, you know, the ballpark itself, you know, it's big, it's spacious. You got the 360-degree concourse, a kind of carnivalesque area in the outfield with a lot of, you know, food and games out there. You know, great sight lines that are very city centric. There was a Marriott hotel that opened up in the last 10, 12 years that is in left field, that really dominates that portion of the left field skyline. And when I was in town, prior to the Colts opener, like, I don't know how they do this, but like the entirety of this Marriott hotel had a huge Colts logo on it. And I think they can change that. So it's not like they paint it on there, but Sam will see if that Colts logo is still on there or something else when he's at the ballpark tonight. So I'm not jealous of Sam Dykstra. I've had my Indianapolis experiences. I'm just glad that he's there. And it's a really, truly is a fun place to see a ball game. I'm glad I got there last year. And if you're looking for, you know, continuity to the older era of Indianapolis Indians baseball, their announcer, who I wrote a feature story on last year, Howard Kelman, has been broadcasting for the team since 1974. He has got 50 years with the Indianapolis Indians. I believe he's the longest tenured in all of minor league baseball, although Jim Weber with the Mudhens is right up there as well. So, yeah, it's a cool place. A lot of history, but still a fun, vibrant experience. And that ballpark is not old, as I said, but it doesn't even seem as old as it is, you know, now in its third decade.
Yeah, and it's interesting you brought up Caitlin Clark, because she's like maybe the sports story of the past week and a half. Even after losing the national championship to South Carolina, her going first overall in the WNBA draft and then going here to the Indiana Fever. This is now a town with two number one overall picks, at least temporarily, until Paul Skeens gets called up. And the Indians even posted a cool video of Paul Skeens like welcoming Caitlin Clark and wishing her well and all that kind of stuff. And I wonder, I mean, like you said, this is a major league sports town. This is a big sports town. They love their sports here, college, pro, what have you. How much her fan, like her being here, is going to be a, you know, rising tide lifts all boats situation. Like there's going to be an even bigger sports fever because, no pun intended, because of her move to the city. So I'm interested to see what that, but maybe I'll see some Caitlin Clark jerseys around the ballpark tonight. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
I learned recently, a friend of the podcast, Todd Radom, designed the Indiana Fever logo back in like 1998, 99. Had no idea. But another one of Todd's fantastic works, which we've had Todd on the show. We've talked about all his work in minor league baseball. Pretty awesome.
Yeah. The amount of times he popped up, like, hey, here's this event. Oh, yeah. I designed the logo.
By the way, I did this.
25th anniversary. Yeah.
What? Really?
Yeah. Pretty amazing. Of course he did. Yeah.
Ben, if fans are going to games in Indianapolis, as Sam is, what were some of the highlights or what are some of the things that stand out about, you know, the city or places that you got to visit? Obviously, you know, your trips involve stops at cool restaurants and record stores and other things. Is there anything that you remember especially about Indianapolis?
I mean, not a ton, as I said, just because my time has been short both the times I've been there on a road trip in terms of really exploring. But it's just the centrality of the location that when you're there, you have access to everything in downtown. There's a famous old steakhouse, and the name is eluding me right now, that's walking distance from Victory Field. It's been around for something like 100 years, and they have a famous shrimp cocktail. So if you got a little cash.
St. Elmo Steakhouse.
Yes, that's it. St. Elmo's.
That's what it is.
Famous for the shrimp cocktail. My designated eater in Indianapolis last year was Will Carroll, who's been well known in sports media for a long time. He's the injury expert, writes about players' injuries, but he's based in Indiana and came out to the ballpark to meet with me. And he was saying to me, like, you're in Indianapolis, like one night after the game, walk to St. Elmo's and get a shrimp cocktail. And I did walk to St. Elmo's. But again, the Colts were in town the next day. It was pretty crowded. There didn't seem to be a seat at the bar. And especially when I'm by myself, I just feel like, oh, I don't want to be lonely in this crowded restaurant and sit alone at the bar. Some people thrive in those situations of just like, I'll see who I meet and I'll just talk to people. But I just was like, nah, I'm not going to eat this like $30 shrimp cocktail at a bar by myself that's crowded. And then I went to Buffalo Wild Wings like I always do.
Well, Ben, tell us about you got some stuff that is up on the site, coming to the newsletter as well. The promo preview is back in its newest, latest, and greatest form here in 2024. What's part of the newsletter and what's up on the site?
Yeah, promo preview was literally the first article or first thing I ever wrote that was within the niche that now I've made my career. So that goes all the way back to 2006. It's appeared in various forms over the last, oh goodness, 18 years, not as regularly, but I think we're going to bring it back this season more on a monthly basis going forward. But here in April, before my road trips have kicked off, which once again do kick off on May 2nd in San Jose, then moving on to Modesto, Stockton, and Sacramento. But since I'm not on the road yet and was under the gun for something, I thought I'm bringing back promo preview. And so the one I did this week in my newsletter, the Ben's Biz Beat, as well as MILB.com, does take cover this week. Actually, starting Thursday, yesterday, for those listening to the podcast, the day it comes out, and going into next Wednesday. So it was just fun to look around in April, which is not, the heaviest promo month, but also realizing like, hey, wow, there's like a lot of cool stuff to highlight. And per usual, I highlighted, the stuff that's a little quirkier and strange. And I won't read every single one of them, but April 19th, that is today, the day the podcast comes out, Friday, the Akron Rubberducks are staging Travis Loudon Appreciation Night. Reporting that he's funny, smart, cool, and can bench press 400 pounds. He's also a secret agent, but don't tell anybody. That is all probably not true, but who Travis Loudon is an Akron Rubberduck season ticket holder. And they've done that promotion, every year for a number of years now. And I always like, I've said this on Twitter and just talking to people. It just seems like one of those ideas I thought the rest of the industry would jump on of doing that kind of theme night to honor a season ticket holder. But I really haven't seen it outside of Akron of just making a season ticket holder the focus of a theme night, throwing out the first pitch, being in between inning contests, having, themselves on the video board, just getting the VIP treatment. So congrats to Travis Loudon, this year's honoree. It seems like we're always talking about the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp, but also tonight, Friday, April 19th, is quote the rave in Give Me More. And this is a tribute to Edgar Allan Poe and also raves, like parties. Quote the Raven, Give Me More. I think they're going to go heavier on the rave aspect and actually stage like mini raves between every single inning for like 30 seconds with the lights all flashing and glow sticks and dancing, EDM music, all that kind of thing. So just another kind of you have to be there absurdity from the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp. Hockey night in Wisconsin on Saturday. Wisconsin Timber Rattlers in Appleton, Pennsylvania, or in Appleton, Wisconsin. They're not in Pennsylvania. They are the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers in Appleton. And I bring that one up only because their giveaway is Fang, their mascot, on ice skates and doing like a pirouette. And I just love the visual of a snake who's already a weirdo because he has legs. Now he's ice skating and doing a pirouette. Just a bizarre visual to have a snake roller or snake ice skating bobblehead. That'll be given away on Saturday. And I would be remiss if I did not bring this one up. On Tuesday, April 23rd, the Altoona Curve are bringing back Awful Night. You know, they began the legend of Awful Night. The first promo I ever covered on site was 2007 Awful Night with the Altoona Curve. When Tyler was broadcasting for the Curve briefly, I'm not sure if that was during the Awful Night era.
You know, I don't remember Awful Night. I was there in 2012. I don't remember Awful Night.
Yeah, the one I attended in 2007 was Awful Night 5, and I know they did it a few years after that, but then it just kind of fell by the wayside, and other teams have done it. But the concept is just, of course, you're not trying to make the experience truly awful, but just doing things wrong for fun. The one I went to in 2007, I got the giveaway when you walk in the ballpark was a spork. There was a man named Captain Awful with no shirt on and a cape, you know, singing a falsetto, "Take me out to the ball game." There was misspellings on the video board. There was like intentionally awful karaoke. It's that kind of thing. So what will the Curve do on Tuesday? I don't know, but I'm looking forward to it. And if I was in a different era of my life, i.e. still single as I was for low those many years, I would probably just go to Altoona on Tuesday just to say, hey, here I am 17 years later. I'm still going to cover an awful night because that's somehow what I've decided to do with my life. So I wish I was out there to see it and see how the Curve approach awful night in this new era. So those are some of the promos. Of course, I have a promo in here that it ties into our one of our interview or our interview segment this week, which should we get to that right now? Or do we want to make that a clean segue? Or is it time for the clean segue? It's not really a clean segue when you talk clunkily about how to segue, but here we are.
I say we go for it. I'm excited to hear it. So I say we go for it. Tee it up, Ben.
I'm going to tee it up so clean, so smooth, so concise. And that is, this is a topic we've talked about on the podcast before. And we said, hey, more investigation needed. So I did that investigation, i.e. talked to the general manager of the Wichita Windsurge, Matt Hamilton, about a new alternate food-based identity debuting tonight, April 19th, Friday, and also will be taking place on Saturday the 20th, the Wichita Chili Buns, a cinnamon roll inside a bowl of chili. And I wanted to get the scoop or the skinny, definitely not the skinny really, considering what that item is, but regardless, wanted to learn about chili buns and what the Windsurge are doing to celebrate chili buns and also to bring it all back and have a call back. The Wichita Windsurge, their primary logo, designed by Todd Radom. But anyway, we're going to talk about the chili buns.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The Wichita Windsurge have a new food identity debuting at the ballpark this weekend, April 19th and 20th, the Wichita Chili Buns. And when this was announced a month or two ago, I had never heard of a chili bun before. I'm sure a lot of other people out there had not heard of it as well. So we're going to get into what a chili bun is and what the Windsurge are doing with this new identity with the general manager of the Windsurge, Matt Hamilton. Matt, thanks for joining the Show Before the Show podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Cool. Well, quickly, before we get into the chili buns, you're a relatively new arrival on the Wichita Windsurge scene. What was your path that led you to the GM role in Wichita?
Sure. So to keep it short, I got my career started in Amarillo, Texas, and helped launch the Sod Poodles brand. I was able to come on board in the corporate sponsorships arm of things back in 2018, of course, opening in 2019. We got through the COVID year and into the 2021 season. And following the 2021 year, I made the move to Scranton-Wilkes-Barre to go on to be the assistant general manager for the Rail Riders. Was there for 2.5 years, two full seasons before ultimately the opportunity to come down here as the general manager for the Windsurge.
Well, congrats on the new role, and I'm sure your to-do lists are full to bursting these days, you know, taking on that role so late in the offseason and in your first season with the Wind Surge. So obviously this Chili Buns identity was fully fleshed out by the time you arrived. You know, what was the process, you know, before you got there, you know, to your understanding of, you know, how this came about? And I guess before you get into that, for those who don't know, what are the specifics of a chili bun?
Yeah, so a chili bun it's a cinnamon roll and chili, and you eat the two together. And it's that sweet and savory combination that is really, you know, born here in the Midwest, primarily Kansas, from what I understand. And the way that it came about is, you know, there's an overwhelming trend across minor league baseball to create these theme night collections that are centered around food items that are unique to your area. And so that said, you know, here in Wichita and Kansas specifically, it starts when the kids are real young. It starts in the lunchrooms and on colder days where, you know, you really want something that can warm you up from the inside out. The lunch ladies would, you know, make chili, and then they would also make cinnamon rolls. And then, you know, you just dip them together and it gives you that kind of stick to your ribs, warm feeling from the inside out on a cold day.
Nice. And what was your familiarity with chili buns before arriving in Wichita and taking this job?
So I had heard about it. You know, I'm a native Texan, so Kansas isn't too far from where I'm from. And so I'd heard about this kind of combination. I have some friends who are from the state, and I always just kind of raised an eyebrow at it. You know, you hear that combination, and if you're not familiar with it, of course, it sounds a little weird. But ultimately, when we were getting ready to roll out the Chili Buns brand, you know, whenever I got here, you know, I've kind of assumed the marketing lead for the organization for the time being. And so I wanted to create a video that really explained what it is and also, you know, helped on the marketing rollout side of things to give some backstory to those around the country who didn't know. And so in that, we had to have our food and beverage department make up a few to shoot the video. And so I was able to try it myself for the first time and pleasantly surprised at how great the combination is, because I was skeptical in my own respect. But nonetheless, the one thing that I think that I've taken away from this is that Wichitans and Kansas, you know, natives alike, they wholeheartedly love this combination. In fact, we have a pitcher on our roster, Scott Engler, who is a Wichita native. And when we rolled this out, he was over the moon because he was able to like talk to his teammates about it and talk to, you know, other, you know, people who had their hesitations. But we've done some stuff recently to show the players kind of getting their first opportunity to see what the chili bun combination is. And they were all very surprised as well. So it's a great combination. Don't knock it till you try it. It's been awesome. It's kind of like eating cornbread and chili together in a way, but instead it's just got a little bit more sweeter to it.
Yeah, the sweet and savory. You mentioned it being, you know, a comfort meal and you know, something kids would eat at school. Are there places in Wichita, you know, restaurants that are known for, oh, go here if you want a really good chili bowl?
Yeah, there's actually quite a few places that serve it. And each person in our front office has their place that they say has it better. And what we've really found is that the true debate is, do you have your cinnamon roll on the side and rip it and dip it? Or do you put the cinnamon roll actually in the chili and cut it up in there with a fork and take it in scooped bites? So we actually have a poll running on our social media right now to see how people eat their chili bun respectively.
And you're new to the chili bun scene, but what's your preference so far?
I've done it both ways. And truthfully, I like to do it with, and I'm the outsider on this because the vote right now is heavy rip and dip, but I'm on the mindset of, you know, you get your fork in there and you kind of scoop it out. And I actually started at the middle of the cinnamon roll a little bit softer. And so you get that middle carved out and take a big bite. And honestly, just incredible.
Obviously alternate identities, they need, you know, strong visual elements. So the team will be taking the field wearing these chili bun uniforms. To me, what jumped out is maybe sort of a classic diner kind of retro motif to the uniforms. But if you could explain, you know, the visual elements of the identity and, you know, why the team went in that direction.
Yeah. So it's really hard to paint a picture of a cinnamon roll and a bowl of chili. So there was a few logos that got rolled out. And ultimately the one that we went with is the one that you see now with the cinnamon roll stuck in the bowl of chili. And it just painted a clearer picture of what it is that a chili bun is and then what the combination is. Otherwise, it just would have been a cinnamon roll next to a bowl of chili and everybody kind of been probably raising their eyebrow a little bit more. And then the chili bun's name, I mean, there was a few different ways that we wanted to roll this out. I've talked through the ideation process and there was the chili rolls, the chili cinnamon buns, and it's just something about chili buns that brings a smile to your face when you say it. So as soon as we got to that point, it was kind of like, okay, that's the name we're going with. And then from a uniform, perspective, of course, you have to think, from a chili coloration, it's kind of got that deep, hearty maroon color to it. And then that kind of creamish color is to represent the cinnamon roll with the actual glaze on top so that to show that the two marry together.
Excellent. And so they'll be taking the chili buns will be taking the field for the first time on Friday, April 19th. We're talking just one day before that. Also doing that on the 20th on Saturday as well. So what are the activation elements of this promotion? What's going to make a chili buns night different than a quote unquote normal night at the ballpark?
Yeah. One of the biggest things we've seen is an overwhelming support from across the country from a merchandise standpoint. People have been buying all the way to Hawaii up to, New York. And so in that, we also got national recognition from, I don't know if you saw, Wendy's interacted with us on Instagram and on X and on Facebook and talked about how cool that is. And then now Bush's Chili Beans has actually come on as the national sponsor of it. So I think that alone, so we're going to have some Bush's Chili Bean t-shirts that are going to be, represented for the chili buns that are going to be handed out to some fans, which was an added layer to tonight. But we never really sell chili buns in the ballpark. And so we're going to have it featured tomorrow and on Friday or on Friday and Saturday so that fans can actually purchase chili buns. And then we're going to take our on-field promotions and try to add in some elements. We all know the famous scene from The Office of, Kevin falling over with the chili pot. So we'll come up with some on-field promotions to kind of lean into some different chili puns and chili buns and things of that nature. All the beauty that is minor league baseball and the unique and goofy things that we can do, we're really going to lean in heavy on them.
Yeah. You mentioned Kevin from The Office, Brian Baumgartner. I think I read somewhere that he's involved as well, maybe not at the ballpark, but he signed some items or something like that.
So he's actually created some, he's going to do a social media push for us because he's got a national partnership with Bush's Chili Beans. And so he's going to be a big supporter and help drive the promotion of this event or these two nights. And so I'm happy to have Kevin Malone / Brian Baumgartner involved. And honestly, like, there's always hesitation when you roll out a unique brand like this. You never know if it's going to resonate with your local fan base, let alone the national fan base. And we've just been so happy with the overwhelming support that we've gotten from it to the point to where, like I said, we're starting to run out of merchandise items, which is a great problem to have. But the response has been great. And, Kevin and or Brian, I should say, and Bush's Beans have been phenomenal supporters.
Yeah, so you were just talking about the reaction that you've gotten. It's been a good one, and selling the merchandise nationally, which I know is always the goal with something like this, to break beyond the local. But it is still first and foremost a local thing. What kind of feedback have you been getting from fans about this, both positive and negative? And as we know, sometimes, like, this is your first alternate food identity and that the franchise has done. Sometimes fans are just confused, so what's been the process of, getting the word out and just hearing from the fans, the people most likely to actually, be there at the ballpark for these games Friday and Saturday?
Yeah, no, when we rolled it out initially, the immediate response in the market was people were flying to the team store to get the hats and get the jerseys and the t-shirts. We have a shirt that literally says beer, buns, and baseball. And I think that's one of the funniest, greatest shirts out there. And so fans have been coming. And so locally, we have seen no negative. It's all been super positive because it's a piece of this area that, it's no matter your age demographic, it goes back to when you were a kid. And so you create that nostalgic moment of, I remember when we used to eat that in school, or I go here at this local diner to buy it, or whatever it may be. And then now we've just been creating more conversation around it of how do you eat it? Going back to the poll that we have running. And on top of that, of course, a little bit of confusion to your point, people don't, not always fully understand it, but whenever those people come and ask those questions, we're happy to explain. It's just for a couple of nights, and it's our way of paying homage to the local area and a local food item that really is true to Wichita and true to Kansas.
Yeah, so you're debuting this pretty early in the season. Do you have plans later in the season or a longer-term Chili Buns action plan, or is it just getting through this weekend and then, you know, assessing from there?
Right now, the plan is just to do the 19th and the 20th this weekend. Obviously, the overwhelming positivity around it has helped us go back to the drawing board and take a second look at what we should do moving forward. But no rock solid plans yet. We're just kind of see how this weekend goes. We anticipate it being a great weekend of baseball. Obviously, April is in this part of the country a little bit on the cooler side, so it actually kind of plays well into the Chili Buns night and theme of that. Ribs sticking warm inside out kind of meal. We're looking at 61 degrees on Friday and 54 on Saturday. So it's kind of that perfect meal. And so I think just timing wise, it works out well. Kind of hard to pitch that if it's, 100 degrees in the summertime to say, hey, get some piping hot chili and a cinnamon roll together. So timing is everything in these cases. And so I think right now we're just going to lean in heavy into it as a late spring rebrand for the night, for the couple nights.
Yeah, it makes sense. I had not thought about that, but no one wants a chili and cinnamon rolls on 102 night in July, 102 degree night in July. Good point. Before I let you go, I am no expert on Wichita. I've only been there once, as I've been to most places just for a fleeting night or two. But one thing that was one of my favorite things in the city, and it was it's a aspect of your Turbo Tubs identity, is the statue of a troll underneath a grate. I can't remember exactly where it was, but in a public park area. And you yourself being new to Wichita, have you visited the imprisoned troll in Wichita yet?
Of course. How do you not? That was one of the first things that a lot of folks told me I had to go see. And, the tub races on the Arkansas River are such a big thing here. And, i.e. the Turbo Tubs identity that we have. And people are so passionate about just the things that make Wichita uniquely Wichita. And that's one of the major things. And there's so many things about this community that are just so cool and so unique. And there's so much baseball history to here that it goes so far. I'm sure you saw the museum that we have here at the park.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There's so much to this area. Like, this is, like, in my opinion, the hidden gem of the United States and of minor league baseball. I mean, we've got maybe the most beautiful stadium in the country. My opinion, the most beautiful stadium in the country, and this incredible community of passionate baseball fans. And we're very fortunate, and we love how much our fans really stake a claim to the Wichita Windsurge being their team and really buying into some of the goofy things that we have this year and some of the things we're already talking about and planning for the future.
Right. Well, obviously next on the agenda is the Chili Buns on Friday and Saturday. Wishing you the best of luck with the debut of the Chili Buns this weekend. And Matt Hamilton, GM of the Wichita Windsurge, thanks so much for joining me on the Show Before the Show podcast.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. It was great seeing you.
This podcast to bring you another thrilling edition of Ghosts of the Miners. Now, here's your correspondent and host, Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back to Ghosts of the Miners, and as all of you out there in radio land must identify the legitimate historical ball club or player hiding amidst the fraudulent pair. One once stayed out playing ball till the cows came home. The others are purely for the birds. In the last segment, I asked you which of the following minor league baseball teams did at one time exist. A. The Muskegon High Spirits. B. The Hobbs Sports. C. The Alamosa Smiles. You're a winner if you picked B, the Hobbs Sports, who did indeed play sports, well, at least one, in southeastern New Mexico in the mid-1950s. Not quite 4 miles from the Texas border, Hobbs experienced unhobbled growth in the 40s thanks to the construction of the Hobbs Army Airfield in the early days of World War II. After the war, Hobbs remained a Hobbs for aviation. a hub for aviation. Into this Hobbs bed, hotbed of flight landed the sports, who were named in a name the team contest by local rancher Herman Adlong, who had long odds of winning. There were about 200 other entries, but with the christening of the sports was awarded a season pass to sporting events. The sports had better than a sporting chance of success in the market, as a minor league team did make it through a couple seasons in Hobbs back in the 30s when it was a town of only a few hundred people. And lots of sports fans were hooked in the Longhorn League in the new Hobbs team's inaugural 1955 season. The sports were third in the 8-team loop in attendance, drawing 46,101, but didn't fare quite so well in the standings, finishing sixth. A key lesson from sports is sometimes you win and sometimes you lose, and the sports were good sports in learning it. That 55 Longhorn League season was the one immediately following Joe Bauman's 72-homer campaign with the Roswell Rockets, and Bauman, namesake of the Joe Bauman Award given to Minor League Baseball's annual home run king, and the Rockets were powerful again the year the sports debuted. But not even Roswell could catch up to the San Angelo Colts, who galloped into first place and then swept the Rockets in the playoffs. In 56, the sports were great. That year, playing under a working agreement with the Washington Senators and, along with many other Longhorn League clubs, joining their newly reformed Southwestern League, Hobbs hopped off with the pennant with a 90-52 record, but fell to those steady San Angelo Colts in round one of the playoffs. The next year, they got the worst kind of revenge. They officially won the league championship, but multiple teams, including San Angelo, disbanded mid-season. And at the end of the year, the whole Southwestern League went south. Permanently.
Aww.
And that's how the Hobbs Club became poor sports. Now, on to the question for next time. Which of these players enjoyed the fruits of his labor in the minors of yesteryear? A. Apple Drake. B. Bananas Cook. C. Peaches Nelson. Want to know the answer? Climb a tree. Or tune into the next Ghost of the Miners. But for now, you'll have to excuse me. My producer, Ben Hill, is running the dishwasher, and I've got to outrace them.
The legendary Golden Pipes of Josh Jackson taking us through this week's episode of Ghosts of the Miners. Fellas, a couple things before we get out of here. First off, nothing has ever been on brand for me or this podcast as what I'm about to do right now. As we were recording, I got an email that something had been delivered to me, and it was this 5950 from the Winston-Salem Dash that has Bolt on the front. Bolt, of course, I took in my draft last week for our Class A squads, double A on down. So I've got my Bolt 5950 now. So I love you, Bolt. Someone,
it's just, it looks tremendous.
Yeah,
that's
it. Really does look good.
It's such a good hat. They should just be the Winston-Salem Bolts. I love him so much. I love Bolt.
But I do want to point out the hat that you were wearing, that you now have replaced with your new Winston-Salem Bolt hat. You were wearing, for those just listening to this, as one is wont to do with just audio, Tyler's wearing the Jamestown Jammers hat, which I absolutely love. They were in the New York Penn League through 2014, then moved to outside of Wheeling, West Virginia, I believe, and became the Black Bears. The Black Bears are now part of the Draft League, not affiliated anymore, but actually went to the last, I believe it was the penultimate game of Jamestown Jammers history. And that ballpark, like Russell Dietrich Ballpark, was just such an old throwback. You could kind of see why they were leaving, both because of their attendance and just the, that was a pretty old no-frills ballpark, but I loved it for that reason. So I'm glad to see you wearing that hat. And also, one of the most bizarre accomplishments of my career, I had an insert set in the Topps Pro Debut minor league theme set for a couple years. And in that 2017 Topps Pro Debut insert set, I gave the press box toilet in Jamestown its own baseball card because it was had a perfect view of the field. And so I think it might be the only toilet with its own baseball card.
Wait, let me ask you this question.
It had a perfect view of the field in which direction? Which way did you have to be facing?
If
you were standing, were you looking at the field?
Well, it was just a single toilet. And if you were sitting on it, it would be, you'd have this beautiful view right to your right of the window overlooking the field. So it'd be a great.
Oh, okay. So it was to the side of the. Okay. I got
it. Yeah. And I just never seen a toilet in a press box aligned like that before with there wasn't even a screen on the window. It was just like open air, like that you could just look right out on the field. And I took some pictures of it. And I was like, this is the most beautiful toilet I've ever seen in a press box. Then the offer to do that, those Topps cards came along, which of course was awesome for me. And I gave that toilet its own baseball card. And now you, in the year 2024, are wearing a Jamestown Jammers hat, and you're bringing it all back. Jamestown, New York, home of Lucille Ball. There's a museum dedicated to her in Jamestown, and also like kind of the epicenter of soapbox derby racing.
Oh, interesting. I don't think I knew that. I did know Lucille Ball. I actually, when I was back in high school, went on a trip to, and this might have been middle school, went on a trip to the Hall of Fame, and then drove through Jamestown on the way back to New York, where my mom's family lives. And of course, my mom made us stop and stay a night in Jamestown so she could go to the Lucille Ball Museum. So I've spent a night in Jamestown. This might have been my first ever minor league hat trade. Jamestown might have, it was very early on in doing hat trades when I worked in a front office. But one of the things I love about this Jamestown Jammers logo, it's just an angry bunch of grapes. But the little dude, the little grape guy, he's wearing a hat that is not an on-field Jamestown Jammers hat. And I've always found that fascinating, that sometimes teams will have logo characters wearing hats that the team itself does not wear. Like, I feel as though this guy should be wearing a hat that also features him holding a baseball bat, just like he is in the logo. You know what I mean? Like, he's got this hat with a J on. That doesn't
really have one of those. Then
it's
that would
be
go
like an infinite regression of hats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think when it comes to infinity, that's more expensive to stitch, though. So they probably just went for something simple.
You never know. I got to get on that. I got to figure out if there's like a, how tiny does your stitching go at New Era? How many different hats can we, you know, when like a mirror is facing a mirror and it just goes on forever? All right. Too complicated for the hat production. Okay, you guys, before we get out of here, we have one special shout out that we need to give this week. And that is to Cheryl Soborowski, who tuned in last week for the first time to the Show Before the Show podcast. And we made a crack about, hey, if this is your first time listening to the Show Before the Show, please get in touch, podcast@milb.com. And Cheryl emailed us and said, just listen to my first show. Love the newsletter too. Go Seawolves, Cheryl. And then she hashtagged it, howl yeah. So she was tuned in for the Erie Seawolves conversation last week. But I just love that we threw that out there and somebody was like, hey, it is my first episode. I got to email these guys.
Yeah, shout out to you, Cheryl, and congratulations on the Erie Seawolves 2023 Eastern League champions, which we of course detailed on that episode of the podcast.
And you can get your cool gear, your cool league champs merch, as we talked about in that interview last week. All right, guys, well, we're about to wrap this thing up, but Sam, I believe, has a player for this week's episode of Name That Dude, which is the title that I came up with for this segment last week and then told Sam that I was just going to keep.
I mean, that's fine. I'm totally on board with that. It's very simple. It's self-explanatory, and I'm all for that. The one hint I will give you guys on this one, and I don't think this is going to give it away, but this is a player who has been in the news this week.
Caitlin Clark.
This player was drafted first overall last year. Can you
this
guess?
This player is starting the game that Sam is going to tonight.
Yeah. No, it is not Paul Skeens or Caitlin Clark. This player was drafted in the second round by the Yankees in 1984. I will not give you any other clues about where he was drafted from. That might give it away. We can circle back to that later. So he was drafted by the Yankees in 1984. His first assignment was to Oneonta. In the New York Penn League. That's another New York Penn League shout out, the Oneonta Yankees. Oneonta? I'm sorry.
I think it's Oneonta. Yeah,
Oneonta.
2006 or so. They were with Detroit after the Yankees.
Yeah, Oneonta. Excuse me. Sorry for everybody on that one. Fort Lauderdale.
Oneonta.
I know.
Or Oneonta is cratering.
He went to Fort Lauderdale. In the Florida State League in both 1985 and 1986. the Fort Lauderdale Yankees again. And then he went to Columbus and Albany Colony Yankees of the Eastern League. And then he bumped between Columbus and he made his debut in 1987 during his age 21 year. Was pretty much up the rest of the time. He did some rehab assignments in Dunedin and with Syracuse for a while there. But he finished his career with 19 major league seasons, times with the Yankees, the Blue Jays, the Marlins, and the Mets. And then he finished up with both the Marlins and the Yankees in 2005.
You said that was how many? 19 major
league? 19
major league career. 19 major league seasons. Yes. I haven't said his position. I don't want to. I can give that next, but I want to see if you guys have any guesses. So Yankees, started his career with the Yankees.
Yankees, Marlins, who else?
Yankees, Blue Jays, Marlins, and the Mets. 7 years with the Mets, 7 years with the Blue Jays, 4 years with the Yankees, and 3 years with the Marlins. And if you're doing the math at home, that's a split year counts as a year. So that adds up to 21, but it was 19 years in the bigs.
I have a thought, but I don't think he was ever on the Marlins.
Go ahead.
That I remember. No, it's definitely not him.
Just guess. Let's get one guess in and I'll.
He was on the Mariners forever. So, and that was not one of the teams you listed.
Okay. No, this guy didn't know.
I think we might need a position to narrow this down.
All right. He was a pitcher.
Okay.
He finished with 162 career wins, an ERA of 3.80, and had 1,974 strikeouts.
Somebody, I always say, whenever we're doing this segment and we can't get it, I always think of someone driving down the road, yelling at their podcasting device, phone. Like, it's whoever.
And again, I will go back to this is a guy who was in the news this week.
He was in the news this week.
This seems too obvious to pitch 19 years into the 21st century.
Yeah.
Yankees and Mets, I just feel like it should jump right out.
It should. It really should.
This.
Sam, you're making us feel better about ourselves.
My next hint will be that he was a left-handed pitcher. He was on two all-star teams, so wasn't exactly stellar at any single point. The highest he ever finished was sixth in Cy Young voting, and that was with the Mets in 1998. He had a 2.47 ERA that year, finishing 17-6. The left-handed pitcher. Here's the hint I didn't give you before, but I will give you now. He was drafted out of a high school in New Jersey.
Oh, yeah, I really get it.
Al Leiter.
Al Leiter is correct.
Should have known. We should have known, especially given his familial connections to the big baseball story of the week. Yeah. Dang it. How did we not get
that? That's what made me think of it.
That's why.
As we're recording, Jack Leiter is debuting for the Texas Rangers.
Right.
Overall pick out of Vanderbilt.
When I think back on Al Leiter's career, like, it's weird. I'm probably going to get yelled at by, like, I don't think of him as a Met as much. Like, I do think of Al Leiter as a Blue Jay. I even remember Al Leiter's time with the Marlins, but like, I don't really think about Al Leiter on the Mets all that much. And like, he was on a World Series team with the Mets. So like, I probably should think about that more, but like, I think when I think Al Leiter, I think like, oh yeah, Blue Jays, Toronto Blue Jays lefty Al Leiter. Which is a little weird.
I mean, he won a World Series with the Blue Jays, and then he won a World Series with the Marlins, and went to the World Series with the Mets.
He was he was an All-Star the year before that Marlins World Series in '96. Probably should have gotten that.
I should have gotten that, and I will not talk too long about this. But I wrote about Al Leiter from the start of the 2005 was his last season. From the start of the 2005 season until the end. And it was part of this just baseball writing project I set up for myself that year that had three recurring segments. And one of them involved Al Leiter. It was because in the year 2004, for some reason, towards the end of the season, I kept noticing that Al Leiter was. Do you have a good ERA in 2004, Sam?
Hold on. Stand by. In 2004, he had a 3.21 ERA. So, yes.
Yeah. So I think he was in the mix for ERA leaders, not maybe leading the league, but in the top 10. But he kept falling off of it because he didn't have enough innings to qualify. Like, how many innings did he pitch in 2004?
Keep clicking away from this page, and I shouldn't be doing that. 100 2/3.
Yeah.
So he, which by today's standards is pretty good.
It is. So he ended up qualifying for the ERA title, but for some reason I started paying attention in 2004 to how he was always on the verge of falling off the qualification list, because to qualify for the ERA title, you have to average one inning pitch per game, 162 for the year. So in the year 2005, I wrote on a weekly basis my own personal column on a blog that almost no one read. And this weekly segment was called the Al Leiter Battle for ERA Qualification. And I chronicled him on a weekly basis to see if he would once again get to 162 innings. And he didn't. But at one point, the Yankees picked him up late in the season, and he had a great first start and made like the back page of the Daily News. And because
finish your story, and I'm gonna have something about that next.
In the midst of heatedly covering this very obscure element of Al Leiter's season, but I was doing it so passionately, I framed this like Daily News cover that talked about him being like rescued from the scrap heap and like, you know, helps the Yankees win, because I was invested in Al Leiter's 2005 season. And he didn't qualify for the ERA title ultimately, and he didn't have a great season, but he hung in there. And he was 39 years old. I remember thinking maybe if the Yankees went deep in the postseason, he'd pitch till he was 40. And totally bizarre. But, you know, that's the kind of baseball writing I was doing on my own as a manager.
So fun fact about that game that you have the framed Daily News from, I was there.
Really?
That was my first ever Red Sox-Yankees game.
Wow.
And I remember being so excited, just being like, I've never been in this atmosphere before. It's going to be so much fun. It's going to be so cool. And then finding out like the Yankees traded for Al Leiter for this game to bring him back. And like it, and then all of a sudden he beat Tim Wakefield in that game. Tim Wakefield threw all 9 innings, just over 100 pitches. But yeah, that game, I just remember thinking like, oh, this is so cool. We were in the back of the back row of the bleachers. We were literally under the Fenway Park scoreboard because that's how we could get in. But I'll never forget watching Al Leiter from like dead center field at Fenway Park beat the Red Sox in my first Red Sox-Yankees game. And then I think like Regis Philbin talked about it the next day because it was such big news in New York that Al Leiter was back.
That's pretty amazing. Now MLB Network's Al Leiter. And Jack Leiter currently making his big league debut for the Texas Rangers. And I guess that'll do it for this week's episode of the show before the show. Fellas, enjoy the rest of your day / Paul Skeens night. And we'll have some more fun next week. I'm going to go post this picture on the internet of my Bolt hat and hope that Bolt sends me like a virtual hug. It's the goal of my day today.
That's why you get the hat, right?
Exactly.
That's why, or the Tyler, that's why you do that.
Yeah. And I'll just close by saying that my portmanteau for you two is Monstra. So until next time, Monstra.
Sounds like kind of a good, like a scary movie creature, like Godzilla versus Monstra instead of Mothra. I like that idea.
Now it's Ben's Biz versus Monster. Let's go.
For Benjamin Hill, Sam Dykstra, Josh Jackson, and all the rest, thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Show Before the Show. My name is Tyler Maughan. We'll catch you next week.